This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest is Geoffrey Littlefield, a writer and producer from the UK who is a passionate fan of the popular music that predated rock and roll, often called the Great American Songbook. His most recent book is a biography of the arranger Nelson Riddle. Written with the arranger's son, Christopher Riddle, the book is titled Music with a Heartbeat. Nelson Riddle is a seminal figure in American popular music in the 20th century, but for much of his life he was overshadowed by the singers for whom he wrote incomparable arrangements, notably Nat King Cole, Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, and Linda Ronstadt. He began his career writing arrangements for the bandleader Les Baxter, who introduced him to Nat King Cole, for whom he wrote the arrangement for this song.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like the lady with a mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely they have blamed you for that Mona Lisa strangeness in your smile? Smile to tempt a lover, Mona Lisa. Or is this your way to hide a broken heart? Many dreams have been brought to your doorstep. They just lie there and they die there. Are you warm? Are you real, Mona Lisa? Are just a cold and lonely, lovely work of art?
It was Mona Lisa, which was a song that Nat King Cole absolutely hated. It came from a war movie, Captain Carey USA, with Alan Ladd, and it was used as a code breaker. It was an Italian song used as a code breaker in this movie. And they said that they wanted Nat King Cole to sing this song. He absolutely hated it. Anyhow, Les Baxter got Nelson in to ghostwrite the arrangement. And once Nat King Cole had heard that arrangement, he agreed to sing it because it totally transformed the song.
Yeah, I know. It's beautiful. That's an iconic arrangement, I think, in my mind. So just to sort of paraphrase, Les Baxter claimed that he wrote the arrangement. It wasn't enough that he didn't give credit to Nelson Riddle. He took credit himself. But
yeah, he took credit. If you look at that record label to this day, it says conducted, arranged, certainly conducted by Les Baxter. It gave no credit to Nelson Riddle whatsoever. But Nat King Cole saw through that because he knew that once he'd heard that arrangement, this wasn't the work of Les Baxter. Les Baxter was a talented guy in his own right as an orchestra leader, but he wasn't an arranger. Yeah, he was getting credits off the back of somebody else. And like I say, it didn't go down at all well with Nelson Riddle. And there was also another number one hit following Mona Lisa. You may remember the song. It's another huge hit for Nat King Cole called Too Young. That was the follow-up. But it wasn't until, you know, Nat King Cole had discovered that it was really Nelson Riddle writing these arrangements. So he offered Nelson a contract that he's a main arranger working at Capitol, so became a member of Capitol Records staff.
And that's under the auspices of Nat King Cole then, because he ultimately became the sort of principal arranger for Capitol Records in the 50s, didn't he?
Oh, he did. He was almost Capitol Records music director, really, for the period. Yeah, I think it was a good 11 years or so. For that period, he sort of ran things, really.
So here he is working with Nat King Cole, who at that point I think was probably better known as a piano player than he was as a singer. And if I remember right from your book, Nat King Cole doesn't really think of himself as a singer, right, initially.
No, like you say, he's more recognised as a jazz pianist and occasional vocalist, I guess. But of course, Capitol, they were very well run in those days. They wanted to, again, you know, produce a new Nat King Cole. They wanted to match that lush vocal, and he had perfect pitch, by the way, with some lush orchestrations, and that's where Nelson came in. and the first that Nelson was credited as arranging and conducting was Unforgettable.
Unforgettable, that's what you are. Unforgettable, though near or far, like a song of love that clings to me, how the thought of you does things to me. Never before has someone been more.
Indeed, and of course, Natalie recorded their version of that, didn't she, in the 80s?
She did, she did. There's a little bit of controversy there. Johnny Mandel was credited with the arrangement of Natalie Cole's Unforgettable, when in fact, if you listening to it, it's almost identical to Nelson's arrangement, except for a stretch in the middle there. So much so, Christopher, obviously, his dad had passed away, but Christopher was absolutely livid when he saw that this had won a Grammy. It had won a Grammy. He was livid, so he took it up with the Recording Academy and said, "Look, this is my father's arrangement." He took it up with Johnny Mandel first to begin with, I might add, and of course he denied it. But to be fair, the Academy recognised that and they issued a special Grammy recognising Nelson Riddle's arrangement.
God, talk about history repeating itself. That's outrageous, isn't it? But
it is outrageous.
Yeah.
And as Christopher pointed out to the Academy president, you wouldn't have done that if my father had been alive.
Yeah, exactly.
That's for certain. Yeah. He'd have been right on that. But there we are. Yeah.
But the other interesting thing, to me at least, about Nelson Riddle's relationship with Nat King Cole, who was a black man in the 1950s,
yeah,
and he struggled as a result when as he moved closer to the mainstream. But Nelson Riddle was close friends with him and with his family, despite the fact that, for the most part, that didn't happen very often, did it? The white families and black families would interact socially like that.
No, it didn't. He became very close to Nat King Cole, and the two families socialized together on a regular basis. And Nat King Cole moved to Hollywood Hills in the 50s. Hancock Park, I think it was, the estate, very salubrious area. And he was not welcomed at all by local residents, far from it. He ended up having a petition given to him and very nasty letters written to him. He had his car keyed on a regular basis. He was quoted as saying, actually, "I've read these letters," he said, "and to be honest with you, I wouldn't want to be living next door to that person either." You know, he had such a classy sense of humour and rose above it all. But yeah, it was a time of great tension, of course, during that period, you know, and, yeah, you know, segregation. Any black artists, they weren't able to stay in the same first-class hotels. They were able to sing in the auditoriums, but But after I packed up and stayed over, it was at a different hotel.
How did that relationship that Nelson Riddle had with Nat King Cole as an arranger, is that what led to him working with Frank Sinatra?
Indirectly, Richard, indirectly. The public story is that it was put out by Sinatra's people was that Sinatra had always wanted to work with Nelson Riddle, you know, having seen his work with Nat King Cole. Well, that may be true in part, but really the real story was slightly different. I mean, Frank Sinatra's career was in free fall after Columbia cancelled his record contract. I mean, he was doing all novelty tunes, wasn't he, in the early 50, you know, sort of 50, 51. Nobody was buying his records. Mitch Miller, the producer, said we couldn't give his records away at the time. He's doing all sorts of novelty songs with Mama Doesn't Bark or something with with a beauty queen called Dagmar. I mean, it was a really off the wall sort of thing. So he wasn't in a particularly strong position at the time. He'd lost that sort of Bobby Soxer status that he's had as a younger man, as a balladeer. But Capitol Records picked up his offered him a contract, but they said, look, we want to give you a new image. We want you to become a swinger. And we have this new young arranger we'd like to put you with and collaborate with. And he wasn't keen to do it to begin with. I mean, he wanted to stay with the status quo. Could he have been with Axel Stordor for a number of years? And he even insisted initially on staying with him. And I think Capitol gave Stordahl an opportunity, but he was writing some lovely stuff, but it just wasn't anything new. Nice as it was, it wasn't new. So they asked Nelson Riddle to write a couple of arrangements, initially in the style of Billy May, funnily enough. And I think he wrote, memory serves me correctly, South of the Border in Billy May's style, which was very nice, and Sinatra liked that. And then he did a couple in his own style. And the one that really was the breakout song, if you like, and became a big hit, was I've Got the World on a String, the Harold Arlen composition.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love. I got a song that I sing, I can make the rain go anytime I move my finger. Lucky me, can't you see I'm in love? Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I hold the string. I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let it go. I got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love.
Once Sinatra heard that, he said, who wrote that one? That's a gasser. And that was the beginning of the relationship.
Which is, it's a really interesting relationship. So you mentioned that in the book that Sinatra's phrasing as a singer was heavily influenced by Tommy Dorsey and Tommy Dorsey's trombone playing. And there's a track by Tommy Dorsey called Polka Dots and Moonbeams, and Sinatra sings about halfway through it starts singing, but for the first half it's a relatively slow ballad with some wonderful trombone playing. I would never have put those two together, but having read your book, listening to him play like that, I can see exactly how that influenced Sinatra's singing. Despite despite the fact that if you listen to the rest of the track, when Sinatra comes in, doesn't sound anything like the Sinatra of the 1950s. If you didn't tell somebody who it was and just played them the track blind, they probably would be hard pressed to even identify the singer. Doesn't even sound like him.
No, I agree. But it's an interesting parallel that they both held, both Nelson Riddle and Frank Sinatra held Tommy Dorsey in such high esteem. Considering Sinatra's well-documented fallout with Tommy Dorsey, I mean, Tommy Dorsey took him to court and everything else. They didn't get, you know, one. There was a big fallout. But the fact that Sinatra said his breathing technique, which was unique amongst his peers, based on side breathing, I believe, which he learnt from Tommy Dorsey's breathing on playing the trombone.
And I guess the result of that is that he could hold a note longer?
Yeah, I think not so much hold the note longer, but it was an almost like a seamless transition. If you listen closely to Sinatra, you'd be hard-pressed to hear where he takes a breath, unlike some singers.
A country dance was being held in a garden. I felt a bump and heard an, oh, beg your pardon. Suddenly I saw polka dots and moonbeams all around a pug-nosed dream. The music started, and was I the perplexed one? I held my breath and said, may I have the next one? In my frightened arms, polka dots and moonbeams sparkled on a pug-nosed dream.
Almost seamless. That's what he learned. And equally, Nelson Riddle couldn't give higher praise to Tommy Dorsey. He almost said, at one point, I think, he said he owed almost everything to Tommy Dorsey and what he learned from him.
Well, that's interesting, because I was wondering, you know, Nelson Riddle wrote arrangements that were a perfect fit for Sinatra's style when he started singing like that. So Sinatra is influenced by Tommy Dorsey, but how did those records come about? Did Nelson Riddle wrote an arrangement for the song and then Frank Sinatra sang to that arrangement? Is that how they got that sound?
No, there was a lot of preparation. What would happen is they'd have a discussion, because Sinatra, unlike Nat Cole, is totally different personalities. Nat Cole is very laid back, had perfect pitch. Sinatra, very intense, very businesslike, was all about the preparation. He would tell Nelson Riddle basically what he wanted. He'd spend a couple of hours, very intense discussion, one-to-one with Nelson Riddle, to the point that Nelson, at the end of it, there was so much flying around that he'd needed an anodyne or something, some sort of tablet to cure his headache. And at the end of it all, Frank said, well, anyway, and that was just the first two tracks, the first two songs. He said, anyway, as regards the rest of the album, just do what you think's best, Nelson. So you had that intense sort of, he want this sort of sound, he want that sort of sound. I think can remember once he said, I want a sound like Puccini. He was mentioning opera singing as well. This was anathema to Nelson Riddle. He hadn't studied the opera singers, and so he's off to the library to do his research. It was very, very intense, but they did that preparation, and that may have gone on maybe 6 months before they actually did the album, because Sinatra was off doing live dates. Obviously, Riddle was doing other work with other vocalists because he was on call. He had a huge roster of artists he was working with in the meantime with Capitol. Sinatra was off live dates and acting as well in movies. But they didn't get back together again until 6 months hence, at which point Nelson was expected to have these arrangements in line with those discussions. Fortunately, he was very, very quick at making copious notes, and he was able to read them back. I don't know about you, but whenever I've had meetings in the past, I write notes in the long hand. I can never decipher what I've written at the time, but I think probably being a master of musical composition and orchestration, he had to be very precise, so he was able to do that.
Okay, so Sinatra was very specific about what he wanted. So was it Sinatra then who came up with that way of singing? It's almost conversational, right? He's famous for it. There's so many people have come since who have modeled themselves on him. But I think he was one of the first people to sing like that, right? I guess, arguably, Bing Crosby was before him.
Yeah, Bing Crosby was, well, Crosby was Sinatra's idol. I mean, people perhaps maybe not aware of how big Bing Crosby was sort of pre-war and through the war. He was the man. He was the number one. But of course, music went out of fashion, that crooning style. Whereas Sinatra, I think, getting back to your point there about his interpretation of the lyrics and the way he sang, delivered the lyric, that was in part, I mean, as he was got older, he had more scars on his heart, and he was able to tell a story more, especially after his relationship and marriage to Ava Gardner. He was heartbroken when that broke up. I mean, that's illustrated in the album Frank Sinatra Sings Only for the Lonely, which is, I might add, or was, Frank Sinatra's favourite album and Nelson Riddle's favourite album, their collaboration on that one. It's not the sort of album you want to be listening to if you're feeling a little bit depressed. Put it that way.
Well, yeah, everything from the cover suggests somebody is sitting in a bar by themselves late at night, kind of feeling sorry for himself.
Yeah, and Sinatra actually did the graphic on that cover. That's his design.
My mama done told me when I was in knee pants. My mama done told me, son, a woman will sweet talk and give you the big eye, but when the sweet talking's done, a woman's a two-face, a worrisome thing who'll leave you to sing the blues in the night. Now the rains are falling, train a calling, we. My mama done told me, hear that lonesome whistle blowing across the trestle, we. My mama done told me, oh, we.
So he clearly had a very, he had in mind a sound he wanted to create.
Yes.
And so he comes to Nelson Riddle and says, this is what I have in mind. And apparently, as you say, went into some detail. You have to feel for Nelson Riddle, while they are, in artistic terms, a wonderful combination, as personalities, I don't think Nelson Riddle would necessarily have been drawn to Frank Sinatra the way he was Nat King Cole. Huh?
Most definitely not. I mean, Frank Sinatra... Obviously, Christopher was in Frank Sinatra's company on numerous occasions, got to know him fairly well. He was very intense, very businesslike, but he didn't require much sleep. It was well known that he would ring an arranger of his, you know, I mean, obviously he was with Nelson long term, but it wasn't unusual for him to be ringing an arranger, orchestrator at 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, because he needed very little sleep. I think Nelson kept him a little bit at arm's length because of that. Mm. He didn't want that close relationship. It was more businesslike, but they had a tremendous amount of respect for each other, of course.
And in some ways, as much as Nelson Riddle did so much other work, that may be the work for which he's going to be remembered in the future.
I think so. I think most people, you know, will remember him, for that collaboration with Frank Sinatra. But of course, he was so much more than that. I mean, he was an accomplished and very successful recording artist in his own right, as well as obviously collaborating with a who's who of other singers of that era, other great singers, Ella Fitzgerald, Judy Garland, Johnny Mathis, Vic Damone, Jack Jones. I mean, the list is endless. Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin, you can go on and on. But yeah, I mean, he will be remembered for his work with Frank Sinatra. But I think, why will he be remembered? Because obviously I think most people recognise that was Frank Sinatra's golden period. I mean, Andre Previn was quoted as saying that Sinatra's success during that period, half of it, was down to Nelson Riddle.
This month marked the centennial of the arranger and band leader Nelson Riddle. The book on his life, Music with a Heartbeat, by our guest Geoffrey Littlefield, is out now. The rest of our conversation will be on Scenic Roots next Wednesday afternoon, here on listener-supported Public Radio.